course, most of us realize the higher critics talk about two Isaiahs. They say when you read the first half of the book, you get a doom and gloom prophet, and then when you get past chapter 40, why, you find a good guy in a white hat with lots of good news and sunshine prophet. So they try to tell you there are two Isaiahs. And there probably were two Isaiahs when he was cut in half, the way he died, but that's the only time there are two Isaiahs. And one thing I like to do is point out some of the numerics as you go through. For example, the name Isaiah is mentioned by name in the New Testament as the author of the passages, or this prophecy, 21 times, which is a key number, of course. Anything divisible by 7 or 12 or 19. And so how many different people wrote about or quoted Isaiah out of the Old Testament? And interestingly enough, out of the 21 times, 11 of them come out of the second half of Isaiah, and 10 of them come out of the first Isaiah. And yet men in the New Testament quoted them all as Isaiah. So any higher critics with their great intelligence that think they've nailed down two Isaiahs, they don't really know what they're talking about. Out of these 21 passages quoted out of Isaiah, they're done so in 6 books of the New Testament, which of course is man's number. Matthew 6 times, in Mark once, in Luke twice, 4 times in John, 3 times in the book of Acts, 5 times in the book of Romans. Okay, Matthew 6 times, Mark once, Luke twice, John 4 times, Acts 3 times, and Romans 5 times. He's named by 7 different speakers or writers in the New Testament. So notice how all these numbers just happened to accidentally come out that way. 7 different speakers. Christ himself refers to him 4 times. And interestingly enough, 3 times is out of the first Isaiah and 1 time out of the last Isaiah. So if you take Christ's words for it, there was just 1 Isaiah. Matthew quotes twice, once from the first Isaiah and once from the last Isaiah. Luke quotes 4 times, all out of the last Isaiah. Out of the times John quotes him, 2 are from the first Isaiah and 1 is from the last Isaiah. John just quotes twice out of the last Isaiah. Paul quotes 6 times, 4 out of the first Isaiah and twice out of the last Isaiah. Now, one of the so-called pillars that there were two Isaiahs is found in the supposed occurrence of certain words that you find in the first Isaiah that aren't found in the last Isaiah. So they say, see, now those are real pillar proofs that there were two Isaiahs. Because some of the words in the first Isaiah aren't repeated in the last Isaiah, but how about words that are repeated? Well, that's not in their favor, in their argument, so they won't bother with that. All examination, though, of a few such words that are cited by modern critics will show the palpable inaccuracy characterizing their assertions. And then you can look up in commentaries a lot of these if you want to, but that's not our purpose tonight. Now, in the quotations out of Isaiah in the New Testament, there are 12 books that give 6 direct quotations. There are 18 books that contain 85 allusions to Isaiah without naming him. Only 7 books out of the 27 in the New Testament don't have any reference to him one way or the other. So much for first and second Isaiah. One thing you might want to always know, and it doesn't make any difference which one you want to refer to, if they thought a little more thoroughly, they'd find out all prophets end on a positive note. You know, no matter how You think about the millennial chapters of Isaiah? Certainly they're from 40 on. But what about Jeremiah? What about Ezekiel? You know what chapters 37 are, and 38 and 39 and 40 through 48. What about some of the others, though? You ever notice Daniel? He ends with the resurrection, the reward of the saints at the first coming of Christ, or at the second coming of Christ. What about Hosea? Well, you scan through, and the very last chapter of Hosea is all about the millennium. What about Joel? He was really a sundowner. You know, he talks about all these locusts and all these critters with teeth and all the drought and everything. But you know what? All of the last part of chapter 2 and 3 are all about the millennium. What about Amos? He had a lot of bad news for a lot of countries. But you ever notice the last chapter of Amos? All about the millennium. Even Obadiah, one little book about one little country, and yet, what is the last verse? All about the millennium. Savior's coming up on Mount Zion. Well, what about Micah? Same thing there. Same thing in Nahum, Habakkuk. So that's one thing you need to learn about prophets. Zephaniah, the whole last chapter is about the millennium. And you know what Zechariah 14 is. And you know what Malachi 4 is all about. So regardless of the bad news that prophets give, they all end on a positive note. They all end with restoration, with millennial prosperity and blessing, and they don't end on the doom and gloom note. Okay, let's get right into the book then. Of course, the name Isaiah itself means the salvation of Yahweh, or Yah. And the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Now, some people right away launch on that and say, okay, you're going to tell me this is about Israel? It says it concerns Judah and Jerusalem. Of course, when you read Jerusalem, you stop to think, well, was that when it was the capital of all 12 tribes? Or was that when it was just the capital of the two tribes of Judah? Well, then he'll have to tell you later. You can't know by interpreting it yourself. But notice then the time setting of the prophet Isaiah. Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. And now turn to Hosea, the first chapter. The word of the Eternal that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. So right away you find the two men prophesied all in the same time, during the same reigns of the same four kings. Now in addition, you might want to notice in Amos, the first chapter, the words of Amos, who was among the herdmen of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel, in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. So Amos prophesied at the same time, but more briefly, and he prophesied more concerning just Israel. And of course, God took different individuals, one, as we'll see a little later in Isaiah, with a background like he had, and then a man like Hosea. We might notice that while we're there in the first part of Hosea. The beginning of the word of the Eternal by Hosea, and the Eternal said to Hosea, you go take a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms. So Hosea was more a living witness against the people that God forced to do things that were stunning and shocking, and yet in to try to shock people into reality and awareness, Hosea had to live as a witness. Now, in the first part of Amos, you'll find Amos had no reason to be a prophet. He was not from the family of the priests or the prophets. He was among the herdmen of Tekoa. So now, all of a sudden, God has Hosea living in his life as a witness against Israel. At the same time, he takes a sheep herder and inspires him to go and tell people exactly the same thing he's inspired Isaiah to tell them, the same things this Hosea is living in front of them as a witness against them. He was just a herdsman. And God said, go. And so he went. Now we might finish off by noticing in Micah, the word of the Eternal that came to Micah, the Merashthite, in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. So apparently after Amos had finished his witnessing, then God raises up another man, Micah, not just a sheep herder, but God tossed in a sheep herder just to show he could inspire anybody he wanted to speak out as a warning against the nation. And then once he proved that, then he dismisses Amos and brings along Micah. So he steps in right after Amos is through and proceeds in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. And of course, those are the capitals of both the ten tribes and the house of Judah. So now back to Isaiah. At least you get the idea. Isaiah would say, well, say, Hosea, are you getting through to those hard heads at all? And they're not listening to me a bit either. He said, well, what about that sheep herder God sent out? They listen to him. They won't listen to the priest. They won't listen to the prophet. And maybe if the sheep herder's telling them the same things, they don't listen to him either. So they were all prophesying at the same time. Now, notice what happens then. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth. Now, right away, that should ring some bells in your thinking. Notice Deuteronomy 32 and verse 1. The victory song of Moses. Give ear, O heaven, and I'll speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. So right away, you're going to find a great number of references back to Moses, back to the Pentateuch, Isaiah perpetually taking you back to laws of the Pentateuch, quotes out of the first five books, references to Moses' sayings, and that's why the people are going into punishment, because they've forsaken the Pentateuch and Moses. They've forgotten all about God's law. And interestingly enough, you're going to find the law of God 12 times in Isaiah. That's a good number, you know, not 13 or 11, but exactly 12 times. So here he starts right off with Moses' victory song. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Eternal has spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. Of course, here he puts it in the plural. So is he talking about a group of people in a mass as a they? Or is he talking about more than one family or more than one house? So we have a car parked in a fire lane. So whoever is the owner of a yellow Toyota with a California license, 491UZB, that needs to be moved because it's parked by a fire lane. Okay. I've nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knows his owner, and the ass his master's crib. Israel, I thought this was all about Jerusalem and Judah. And yet, the very first proclamation out of God's mouth deals with Israel, not Judah and Jerusalem only. So is Jerusalem, in connection with Judah, talking about not just the little nation of Judah, but all of the nation of Israel that had a capital at Jerusalem? Well, we'll just keep on finding out. Israel does not know. My people does not consider. So Israel's lost their ancestry. They don't know who they belong to. They're wandering and not aware of who originated them. But an ox knows an owner, and an ass knows the master's crib. But not Israel. My people. So there you very plainly see, all the way through Isaiah, when it says, my people, it's talking about Israel. My people does not consider. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors. Now you notice it isn't just a minor sin that they're committing. He's using several words here. He's saying the nation is full of sin. The people aren't just mild sinners, but they're loaded down with iniquity, laden with iniquity. And he says they're a seed of evildoers. In other words, it's just passed on from generation to generation to do evil. And those of you that took the doctrines class, remember the different words for sin. There are a lot of different words for sin. And each word is worse and more crooked, more steep and impossible to change. So, note the way God pronounces what's wrong with the nation of Israel. And it's not a mild thing. They're not just beginning to go away. They're laden with lawlessness. The word iniquity, in many cases not translated accurately. A seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors, they have forsaken. Now he begins to give three different terms for how they've gone away from God. First of all, they've forsaken the eternal. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel. And there again is an interesting name of God, the Holy One of Israel. You remember when Ananias went to the Apostle Paul and told him who he was going to listen to, be taught by? He uses the name out of Isaiah here. You'll find this 25 times just in the book of Isaiah. Interestingly enough, 12 times in the good guy, the first half, 13 times in the black hat, the bad guy, in the last half. Then outside of Isaiah, it's used 7 more times, so you have 32 times altogether, which again is a key number. Anytime you have fours, and here you've got 4 and 4 and times 4, and you've got 3 fours actually altogether. Of course, the number 4 is the number of God revealing himself, like the 4 trumpet plagues up here, like the 4 gospel writers, or like many other fours all the way through the Bible. So they've provoked the Holy One of Israel to anger. They're gone away backward. Now the term provoked the Holy One of Israel here is really blasphemed and despised, an old Mosaic word that you find back in Numbers 14:11. Again in verse 23 of Numbers 14, again in Numbers 16 and verse 30, and again in Deuteronomy 31 and verse 20. So you might want to jot those down and notice how many times Isaiah associates the cause of Israel's punishment with the words of the curses and the warnings of Moses. So they blasphemed and despised the Holy One of Israel to anger. They're gone away backward. Why should you be stricken anymore? So now he begins to show you what happens when you degenerate so far as being a sinful nation laden with iniquity, the seed of evildoers. Then all of a sudden you're stricken, and he says, why be stricken anymore? You'll just revolt more and more. The whole head is sick. And of course, the head is the government, the brains that run the body. So God doesn't have very high regard for the middle direction of Israel. The whole head is sick, God says. The whole heart faint, from the sole of the foot, even to the head. There's no soundness in it, whether it's in the economic system or whatever it's in. So when God looks down and sees Israel, he sees wounds, bruises, putrefying sores. And then he begins to describe what you should do with wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. Surprising how much the Bible has to say about food, about first aid, about health. So even in God's Word, if you have wounds, bruises, and putrefying sores, those are different types of injuries, but what God says you should do is close them, bind them up, and mollify them with oil. Now, my brother one time, we were playing football in Texas, and he fell in an open field and cut a big piece of pie out of the heel of his hand, and I already been reading the Bible with the church, and I said, well, God says if you just put that chunk back in there and pour wine and oil on there, and the wine will kill the germs, and the oil will keep it mollified, and that'll heal, and you won't even have a scar. But of course, you put alcohol in there, and it pickles it, and then you try to have it together, and it leaves a scar that'll always pop open again later. But you can't improve on God, you know. That's, you know, like the Song of Solomon. God says, you have a hard time sleeping? Drink your wine with your milk and see what happens. You'll be afraid you slept through the millennium when you wake up. But anyway, going on the description then, your country is desolate. This is a word you'll find in Isaiah 12 times. Isn't that odd? Look how many times things come through in perfection here. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, strangers devour it in your prisons. Now, you'd be shocked if you knew how much of Texas the Arabs have bought up. Farmland, dairy land, or beef country. You'd be surprised how many of the buildings downtown Los Angeles belong to people from overseas. So God says, strangers devour your land in your prisons. Maybe buy up your automobile dealerships or your cities are burned with fire. Of course, that's going to happen later on in the Holocaust. It's desolate as overthrown by strangers. Now you come to one of the keys, and the daughter of Zion. And this is not Mother Zion. This is not old Zion. This is the daughter. And you're going to find that when you refer to any daughter, it's always end time setting. Never is the old original fulfillment of the mother country or the mother city. The daughter of Zion is left as a cottage and a vineyard, as a lodge in a garden of cucumbers. Now here again, the word cottage is the word sukkah, which is the word for booth. Like Job 27:18. But you find God's traveling throne is also called a booth. So don't think the word booth requires something made out of grass or limbs or leaves or anything like that. It doesn't do any such thing. You know, before you get carried away, you ought to just take the word tabernacle and booth and look it all up, and you're going to find out that even God's movable throne with all wheels and all those invisible spiritual components that make up his movable throne, it's called a tabernacle. So don't get carried away with the word. Now, the next word here he talks about is left as a cottage or a sukkah in a vineyard, as a lodge, and yet that's a Hebrew word that just means a platform that's built up on four poles that's sheltered by leaves or sacking. If you've been to Egypt, you've seen sticks stuck in the ground and then sacks on it so they can cool off during the heat of the day. Well, that's what he's talking about here. So if God wanted to use the word for a more temporary dwelling, he got the wrong word for tabernacle. You know, he shouldn't have used the word sukkah. He should have used the word lodge here, because that one can only mean a platform on four poles that's sheltered by leaves or sacking. Even at the end of your harvest, you just leave it out for the weather to do away with. So if God wanted to suggest that the feast is a feast of grass hutch, you know, he'd use that word instead of sukkah. Right there, both of them in the same verse. That's a real good verse to use on that. Now he goes on in verse 9, except the Eternal of Hosts had left unto us a very small remnant, we should have been a Sodom, and we should have been like unto Gomorrah. Now, you're going to see a little later that God is going to leave a tenth in the land. And yet here God says a very small remnant. So you get an idea about how much a very small remnant is, about a tithe, about a tenth. And when this time of the cities being burned with fire, when the daughter of Zion is going to be left like a cottage in a vineyard and a lodge in a garden of cucumbers, a besieged city, except the Eternal of Hosts had left a tithe in it, a small, very small remnant, then we'd have been totally wiped out like Sodom and Gomorrah. But he's not going to wipe Israel out, like Sodom and Gomorrah. Now he goes on, though, since he's brought up the parallel between the destruction totally of Sodom and Gomorrah, now he draws on the leaders and likens them to the leaders of Sodom and Gomorrah. And when you hear some of the deeds that have gone on by a lot of the leaders, then you know what he's talking about. And that doesn't just mean America, you know. That means Norway and Sweden and Switzerland and Belgium and France and all those countries too. Hear the word of the Eternal, you rulers of Sodom, give ear unto the law. And there's the first use of that word that's used 12 times in Isaiah, referring to the whole Pentateuch, the whole first five books. So these rulers ruled as the ones did in Sodom. To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices to me? So right at the same time that God says we've gone the way of Sodom and Gomorrah, he still says we have religion, though. Don't think we've forsaken religion, though. Oh, no, we have a multitude of sacrifices, penances and all kinds of worships, says the Eternal. But God says, I'm fed up with your burnt offerings of rams and fat of fed beasts. I don't delight anymore in the blood of bullocks or lambs or he-goats. When you come to appear before me, who's required this at your hand? Now here, the word tread is a key word. If you want to notice back in Ezekiel 26, and everywhere we can, we're going to tie Ezekiel and Jeremiah right in. Ezekiel 26:11. With the hoofs of his horses shall he tread down all your streets. He shall slay your people by the sword, and your strong garrisons shall go down to the ground. So that's the same word. And notice the description. Hoofs of horses, like what they do to streets. That's what the people of God are doing in the so-called house of God. So the verb is a giveaway here as to what he means, treading. He doesn't just mean coming in frequently, but he means desecrating and corrupting and polluting. Notice Ezekiel 34 and verse 18, same word again. Ezekiel 34:18. Seems it a small thing to you to have eaten up the good pasture? But you must tread down with your feet the residue of your pastures. So notice how it's the same word exactly. Like treading down with your feet the residue of your pastures. Now the same things are mentioned back in Daniel chapter 8. Now God is consistent in what he inspires one prophet to say. He uses the same exact words among other prophets. Daniel chapter 8. And here he's talking about the ram and the he-goat. The battle between the Grecians and the Persians. I saw him come close to the ram. He was moved with choler against him, smote the ram, brake his two horns. There was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him. So that's the same terminology. Whatever the Grecian Empire did to the Persians, that's the word used here. Again, in verse 10 here in this same chapter, this one waxed great even to the host of heaven. It cast down some of the host of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. So what the power in the last days is going to do to some of the Christians is the trampling down or the treading. So when God says in verse 12, they came to appear before him, but they were coming trampling down, tramping down like horses in a war desecrating and my courts. And now God says, bring no more oblations. Incense is an abomination. The new moons and Sabbaths, the calling of assemblies, I can't away with. It's iniquity, even the solemn meeting. Of course, some people think that God is condemning the Jewish holidays here. And yet, if you notice carefully, he says, verse 14, your new moons and your appointed feasts my soul hates. Now, interestingly enough, turn back to Leviticus 23 and notice what God calls them back there. This is a chapter we all should know as well as any chapter in the Bible, really. Leviticus 23, 12 times in this chapter, you're going to find what God has to say about them. Verse 2, concerning your feasts, no, concerning the feasts of the eternal. Notice the last part of verse 1. My feasts. So he's not talking about his feast back in Isaiah chapter 1 or chapter 5. He's directly contrasting that with what he's saying here. The feasts of the eternal, my feasts. Then notice he says the Sabbath of the eternal. Verse 4 he says, these are the feasts of the eternal. Verse 5, the eternal's Passover. Verse 6, the feast of unleavened bread unto the eternal. Verse 17, the first fruits unto the eternal. Verse 33, the feast of tabernacles, 7 days unto the eternal. Verse 37, these are the feasts of the eternal. Verse 38, besides the Sabbaths of the eternal. Verse 39, a feast unto the eternal. Verse 41, you'll keep it a feast unto the eternal. Verse 44, Moses declared the feasts of the eternal. 12 times in one chapter. So Baptists and all say, oh, I see Moses' feast. Judah's feast. Israel's feast. No, that's not what they are. Isaiah is condemning Israel's feast. Do you remember they forsook God's feast in the days of Rehoboam and established their own feast, likened to those that were in Israel? So when Isaiah is condemning what they've gone off into, he's talking about their holidays, their new moons, their appointed feasts, and not talking about God's appointed feasts. You might notice in Hosea chapter 2, prophet at the same time, with the same in the same country, and notice what he has to say. Hosea chapter 2. And then verse 11, jumping into the middle of the chapter like a good Baptist. Verse 11, notice what he says. I'll also cause all her mirth to cease, her feast days, her new moons, and her Sabbaths, and all her solemn feasts. So there he uses the feminine, tying it in with the woman of Israel, her. Now, you know, which one's he talking about? Well, look at verse 13. I'll visit upon her the days of Balaam. That's kind of obvious then who her feast days are, and her new moons, and her Sabbaths, and her solemn feasts. They're the days of Balaam. Baal the sun god, you know, his birthday and his resurrection day and everything else connected with him. They're the days of Balaam. Notice verse 16 what God said. It shall be at that day, you're not going to call me Ishai, and you're going to call me no more Baali. So you see what they are? Look at verse 8 of Hosea 2. She didn't know that I gave her corn and wine and oil and multiplied her silver and gold. What she did, she turned around and used all the wealth God gave the nation. They prepared for Baal. All the pagan religion and all the expense of all their holidays. And now you find the same thing back in Ezekiel chapter 20. So here's another prophet at the same time, except he was in the captivity over in Babylon. Ezekiel 20, verse 11, God says, I gave them my statutes, I showed them my judgment. Which if a man do, he'll live in them. So I gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between me and them. But what'd they do? They rebelled against me in the wilderness, verse 13. They didn't even get into the promised land before they'd rebelled. They rebelled against me in the wilderness. They didn't walk in my statutes. They despised my judgments. So by the time Ezekiel and Isaiah and Hosea come along, they're not walking in God's statutes, which are holy days. They despised God's statutes and judgments, which if a man do, he'll even live in them. My Sabbaths they greatly polluted. Verse 16, they despised my judgments. They didn't walk in my statutes, but polluted my Sabbaths. See, God calls them his all the time. Their heart went after their idols. Now, verse 18, God said, I said to their children in the wilderness, don't you walk in the statutes of your fathers. See, even in the wilderness, the generation that came along after that original generation, God warns them not to walk in the statutes of their fathers. They're not God's statutes. They're pagan. They're worldly. They're after Baal. Neither observe their judgments, nor defile yourselves with their idols. I'm the eternal your God. Walk in my statutes. Keep my judgments. Hallow my Sabbaths. They're a sign between me and you. Notwithstanding, even those children rebelled. They didn't walk in God's statutes or judgments. They polluted God's Sabbaths. So God said, well, I'll just scatter them. And then verse 24, God said, because they had not executed my judgments, but they despised my statutes and polluted my Sabbaths, so I gave them over. Just turned them up, gave them over. Let them go their own way. Let them go to statutes that weren't good. That's the ones of their fathers. That's the ones of Baal. That's the ones Hosea condemned, and that's what Isaiah is condemning here. So hopefully nobody will trick you on Isaiah about these days that he's talking about here. Your new moons and your appointed feasts my soul hates. You know, what is a soul anyway? Even God has one. My soul. Well, we'll look at souls as we go through Isaiah as well. I myself hate it. It's really what he's saying. He's just saying himself is the soul. He's a living being too. They're a trouble to me. I'm weary to bear them. And when you spread forth your hands, I'm going to hide mine eyes from you. Now, what does the rest of the Bible tell you that God hides his eyes from people when they pray? Well, you know, if you teach for doctrines the commandments of men, you worship in vain. And he says, you make many prayers, but if you regard iniquity in your heart, he doesn't hear you. So here again, when he turns away his eyes, it shows that they're not going God's way. They've gone the way of paganism. And you can make many prayers, well, I'm not going to hear. Because of what? Well, your hands aren't living by my law. Your hands are full of blood. You've got to wash you and make you clean and put away the evil of your doings from mine eyes and cease to do evil and learn to do well. Now, how do you put away evil? How do you cease doing evil and learn to do well? Boy, of all things, he brings in the third tithe. And talk about nailing down pure religion and undefiled. He hits right at the core of it, doesn't he? Look at that. Relieve the oppressed, judge the fatherless, plead for the widow. And that's really an emphatic, strong statement. You're going to find God's tithing laws mentioned quite often in the condemnation of Israel. And since it applies to the daughter of Zion, we want to be sure we're not being referred to and being guilty in it. But that's what God says you do when you learn to do well and when you seek judgment. What is God's judgment about those that can't take care of themselves? Well, you know, twice in 7 years you have to set aside to take care of those that can't take care of themselves. So if you seek judgment, what do? Well, you relieve the oppressed, you judge the fatherless, and you plead for the widow. And he mentions, you know, in Hebrew as well as Greek, many times they'll use three in a figurative sense to refer to the all people in need. That's why he says corn, wine, and oil, you know. That's a figurative way of using three that refer to individual areas to cover the whole sum. You know, you look back in Genesis 1, and when God wants to talk about all the creatures that are created, what does he say? Well, he talks about the beasts and the cattle and the creeping things. Just picks three. And that's the Hebrew figurative way of referring to the whole total. So here, you can't get radical and say, well, it just means fatherless and widow, and that's all. No, and those are just three examples of the whole that can't take care of themselves. Now, verse 18 has been greatly mistranslated and greatly misunderstood. Come now and let us reason together. I've had all kinds of people who were independent, free thinkers, stubborn, hard-headed, and they said, well, now, doesn't even God say, come, let's reason together? Well, let's just put an end to that in a hurry, because look up the Hebrew term here. It means the putting an end to all reasoning. God is saying, come and let me put an end to all your reasoning. Come and let me tell you the way it is to put an end to all your worry and uncertainty and reasoning. It means let's put the matter right and settle the matter. Let's put an end to all reasoning. It isn't an invitation to commence reasoning. It's terrible it's been mistranslated that way. Now he says, though your sins, and here's the milest word of all, the missing the mark, though your sins be as scarlet, they'll be as white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they'll be as wool. So it shows when God forgives, he forgets. And that's a great area humans have a lot of growing in to do. If you be willing and obedient, you'll eat the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, and notice all the way through when it talks about someone going God's way, it's always obedient. It's always conquered. If you be willing and obedient, that's the way God's people are, then they eat the good of the land. But what about people that are hard-headed and stubborn and independent? They're not yielded. They refuse and rebel. Then they're going to be devoured with the sword. Now, we're going to notice the summary descriptions God used to punish Israel, because they're the same ones over and over and over that he uses. And this is one of them right here, the sword. So if you refuse and rebel, you're going to be in a captivity. You're going to be devoured by the sword of captivity, for the mouth of the Eternal has spoken it. This occurs many times through Isaiah. Now he begins to describe, once again, the capital city of Israel. And that's why he started out earlier talking about Jerusalem. And not talking about Israel at first, but then he talks about Israel when he says, my people are a sinful nation. So now he says, how is the faithful city? That's what Jerusalem started out as. God's capital of his nation of Israel. They used to be a city for faith and faithful. But God said it became a harlot. Committed illicit relations with all kinds of other countries and gods. So the faithful city became a harlot. It used to be full of judgment. Righteousness used to lodge in it. Now, to even age long enough to be a better wine, but just gobble down in a hurry as fast as they can produce it. Your princes are rebellious. And here they're talking about the sons of the rulers, the second generation of the leaders, politicians, kids. Your princes are rebellious. They're companions of thieves. Everyone loves bribes. You know, I'll give you this if you'll vote for me on that, and you give me this if I vote for you on this. And they're just perpetually buying each other off in the politics. Everyone loves bribes and follows after rewards. They don't judge the fatherless. You think God sees our nation taking care of the fatherless widow and stranger? Not on your life, they don't. How do you judge the fatherless? Well, by taking care of them the way God's judgments say you do. If you don't take care of the fatherless the way God's judgments say you do, then you don't judge the fatherless. Neither does the cause of the widow come to them. So twice in the first chapter, God warns us about the need of taking care of the poor in that third year and the sixth year. Therefore, saith the Eternal, the Eternal of Hosts, the Mighty One of Israel, and that's a name never used except by Isaiah, the Mighty One of Israel. It's again in Isaiah 49:26, and again in Isaiah 60 and verse 16. You might notice Genesis 49 and verse 24. Here again it ties this book back in with the law that Genesis 49. But his bow abode in strength, the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. So here, instead of talking about the mighty God of Jacob, he talks about the mighty one of Israel. So with Isaiah's three uses and that one that's likened to it in Genesis, you got another four there, but I'll ease me of mine adversaries and avenge me of mine enemies, and I'll turn my hand upon you. And that's not very clearly translated. It actually means repeat the judgment on you. I'll bring judgment back on you again. So it's kind of like, well, you were punished once before, and now I'm going to punish you a second time. I'm going to turn my hand back on you and punish you a second time. And purely purge away, refine away your dross, and take away all your tin. Now, right away, you know, if you're not a very diligent student, you'd say, "Say, look at that. In the future, boy, I'm going to go out and buy a ball of tin, because God said he'd take away your tin, my money will just go skyrocketing." So, you know, use the Bible for your investments and go out and buy up all of tin. Except the word isn't tin there. You know, that's the way to lose your money. You better be sure what it says before you use the Bible to go out and become a millionaire. It just means alloys. It doesn't mean tin. I'm going to restore your judges as at the first. I'm going to restore your counselors as at the beginning. Now, did God do that after their first punishment and captivity? No, he really didn't. So this is talking about our day. Afterward, you'll be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. That hadn't happened. They hadn't been returned that way and returned to their title. Zion shall be redeemed with judgment. Now, God's judgments, the trumpets and the seven last plagues, and then God is going to bring Zion back and her converts with righteousness. And the destruction of the transgressors, and here again the word's rebels, not transgressors. It's a far worse word in Hebrew. The crooked people that are bent out of shape. God has to destroy. That's the only way to get rid of them. And of the sinners shall be together, and they that forsake the eternal shall be consumed. For they shall be ashamed of the oaks which you've desired. And here he's talking about the Asherah, the trees that they resorted to for idolatrous worship. You remember that they are in the trees eating swine's flesh, Isaiah 65:3 and Isaiah 66:17. It's repeated again in Isaiah 57:5. So it's quite a common term. It's used in Ezekiel 6:13. So one time God talks about your place of practicing your idol worship as the Asherah, the trees, the oaks, the other place in the gardens. So you'll find it used back and forth. They shall be ashamed of these places of their pagan worship, of the heavens which you've desired, and you'll be confounded for the gardens that you've chosen. For you shall be as an oak. So now God likens their places of idol worship, the oaks and the gardens. And now he says, you're going to be like an oak whose leaf's going to fade. And you're going to be like a garden that has no water. Since you love those oaks and gardens of idolatry and paganism. And the strong among you are going to be set on fire. And there again, the maker of it is not very accurately translated. Here he's talking about the work of the maker. The references again to the trees of their paganism. The strong of the people are going to be burnt. Also, the idols, they're both going to be burnt together, and nobody is going to quench it. You know, that's what's unquenchable. What God doesn't allow somebody to quench. So unquenchable doesn't mean it burns forever. It just means God doesn't allow anybody to put it out until it puts itself out. And that's a good word to mark hell as you're marking your Bible. Okay, the word that Isaiah, the son of Amos, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, so that goes right back again to chapter 1. It shall come to pass in the last days. Now you've got a phrase that we want to be sure we always note. And this chapter is one of the main chapters to show you that in the last days, the day of the Lord, and in that day are all one and the same. So if anybody says, well, you prove that to me, I don't believe that. Okay, just turn to Isaiah 2 and you've got it nailed down. So you watch as we go through there. In the last days, it shall come to pass. The mountain of the Eternal's house. Now what is the mount of the Eternal's house? Well, that's Mount Moriah. That's where the temple is. So that's the physical, literal interpretation. But also symbolically, you're going to find a mountain is a large kingdom, and a house is a church. We're God's house, God's husbandry. So God's church is going to grow into a mountain, a nation, a kingdom in the last days. The kingdom of God's church is going to be established in the top of the mountains. It just popped into my head back up in verse 10 of chapter 1. I forgot to mention something here. Where he says, give ear unto the law of our God. I mentioned about that being used 12 times in Isaiah. But when he says the law of our God, the word God is Elohim. It's not the law of the God of Israel. You're going to find that out all the way through.
When Isaiah refers
to God's law,
he never does
make it national, as if it's the national God of Israel, Yahweh, but it's always the God, the law of Elohim, which means they both instituted it. And you remember back in Exodus 20, if you don't, you probably should turn back there and just be sure you notice this, because people that want to do away with God's law because they're carnal-minded are always going to come up with some trick or some out to try to do away with God's law. And this is one way they do it. They say, oh, well, that is just a national law. That isn't a universal law. Tithing's not a universal law. Well, I wonder why Malachi was so stupid. He said, will a man rob God? And that dummy should have said, will a Jew rob God? Or he should have said, will an Israelite rob God? But he just blew it all there because he said, will man? Somebody forgot to tell Malachi that law wasn't universal. And when you read back in the days of the original reference to tithing in the days of Melchizedek, why does he say he should give that tithe to God? Possessor of heaven and earth. That's what he said, you know. He didn't say possessor of the land of Judah or possessor of the land of Israel. You know, God doesn't say the cattle on the Palestinian hills are mine. He says the cattle on a thousand hills are mine. So don't let anybody pull that trick on you. And some people that used to be ministers got hoodwinked by that same dumb argument. But notice Exodus 20, verse 1. And God, you see that word God, small letters, O-D, that means the word is Elohim. Now, anytime you have a word in capital letters, look at verse 7. The L-O-R-D, capital letters, that's the word Y-H-W-H. And then the Lord, your Elohim, G-O-D, small letters, that's Elohim. So your Bible did that for you. So notice that when you're reading through. So notice who spake all these Ten Commandments. And Elohim spake all these words. So both of the gods together spake the law. Now it's true, the Eternal was their Elohim. That's what verse 1 says. I, the Eternal, I'm your Elohim. Specifically, the God of the nation of Israel was YHWH, the Eternal, your Elohim. But when you get the summary verse in verse 1, the law was spoken by Elohim, not by Yahweh, not just the God of Israel. And Isaiah will refer to that again and again. He doesn't call it the God of Yahweh, the God of Israel. He calls it the law of Elohim, the universal name of God. Now, that's kind of stupid to do that if it isn't the universal law. But he always does that. Now, back to Isaiah 2 again. It will come to pass in the last days, the mountain of the eternal south shall be established in the top of the mountains. So contrary to the Adventist, Christ's return doesn't make the whole earth desolate. No, that's not true. God's mountain is established in the top of the mountains. They're still left there. It's going to be exalted above the smaller countries, too, the hills. And all nations shall flow unto it. Now, you know, if you don't take this both literally and symbolically, and you say, well, now, wait a minute, the mountain is Moriah and the house is the temple. Okay, then read a little further. What's the hills? You got mountains and hills both there in the same verse. Well, I guess the Palestinian hills and the, or mountains, and the hill is Moriah. Well, that's not hills, that's one hill. Well, you have to take it both symbolically and literally. Okay, read on. Shall be exalted above the hills in all nations. Now here again, you've got to watch out for the word all in the Hebrew and in the Greek, because it's a figurative
terminology that means many from among all nations. Does not mean every single one without exception. The word all never does mean that. You can't interpret it in modern English. Now he said, many from among all the nations shall flow unto it. Now, there's an interesting word, because in the unity of God's prophecies, look how much everybody says the same thing. Notice Jeremiah 31 and verse 12. Jeremiah 31, verse 12. Therefore they shall come and sing in the height of Zion, and shall flow together for the goodness of the eternal, for wheat and for wine and for oil, for the young of the flock and the herd. Their soul shall be as a watered garden, and they'll not sorrow anymore at all. How do you water somebody's soul like a garden? That's kind of hard to do, isn't it? But notice the same exact term used with picturing the millennium. Then again, you might notice another example back in Micah chapter 4, and that's almost word for word. Remember, Micah over here was there at the same time and prophesied along with Isaiah, and maybe even copied this out of Isaiah, because he uses the exact same words. Micah 4, in the last days it'll come to pass, the mountain of the house of the Eternal shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it'll be exalted above all the hills, and people shall flow into it. Well, if you ever saw two verses that are just almost identical in the Hebrew, look at that. It'll come to pass in the last days, the mountain of the Eternal's house will be established in the top of the mountains and will be exalted above the hills. All nations will flow to it. And there they were, prophets at the same time, at the same area. Okay, going on then. And many peoples, the word should be plural there, many peoples shall go and say, come you, let's go up to the kingdom of the Eternal, to the house of the Elohim of Jacob? Boy, oh boy, I wonder why he'd call him that. It's supposed to be Yahweh of Jacob. I thought, no, no. God the Father and the other member of the Elohim family are both the God of Jacob. One of them was more the direct, literal spokesman or individual God, but here the word is Elohim. So don't let anybody kid you about the God of Jacob always having to be the one and only Yahweh. That isn't true. Here it's Elohim. And he'll teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths, because out of Zion shall go forth law. The law is not what it says there. The article's not there. What law? Well, statutes, judgments, Ten Commandments. As a matter of fact, even ceremonial law in the beginning of the millennium. So he's not just saying the Torah is going to go out. He's not just saying the law. Now he's saying, out of Zion shall go forth law and the word of the Eternal from Jerusalem. And he's going to judge among the nations, rebuke many people. They're going to beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation is not going to lift up sword against nation. Neither shall they learn war anymore. Now, some people are dumb enough to tell you we're already in the millennium. Well, I don't know how that can ever be. Of course, what I read in the last days, when God's mountain is established, they're going to beat their swords into plowshares, and the nation won't lift up sword against nation. But I remember one day in the Baptist church, they said, well, which are you, premillennial or postmillennial? I never even heard either one of them, you know. I just pleaded ignorance and proved it, and I said, well, I don't know, I never heard either one. They said, well, you got to be one or the other, and I said, well, maybe I have to, but I don't know which one I am. But you know, some of them believe you're already in the millennium. If you can imagine that, you know, go down to the zoo and stick your arm in the lion's cage and you'll find out in a hurry. If they won't eat you, you know, if they won't bother you. We had proof just a few days ago you're not in the millennium. The guy that wandered into the lion's cage over there. Well, anyway, notice going on then in verse 5. O house of Jacob, come you, and let us walk in the light of the Eternal. So even the house of Jacob hadn't been doing it. Their error wasn't because they were walking in the light of the Eternal. No, their error was that they weren't walking in the light of God. They've gone in their own statutes and judgments. Therefore, you've forsaken your people, the house of Jacob. Because they've be replenished from the east. And that's not very well translated. It really means they've been filled up with divinations. They're going after all kinds of paganism from the east, out of Egypt. They're soothsayers like the Philistines. They please themselves, which literally means just joining hands with these children of strangers, joining hands with pagan religions from strange peoples, not of God, not of God's word. Their land also is full of silver and gold. They're in the end of their treasures. Their land is full of horses. They're in the end of their chariots. Their land is full of idols. And if you don't think God knows that, God from heaven looks down and sees all the steeples and all the idols, all the Christmas trees and all the things in the at Easter season and Halloween and all that. And God sees the land is full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands, that which their own fingers have made, whether it's creeds of men or whether it's Christmas trees or whatever it is. And the mean man bows down and the great man humbles himself. Therefore, don't forget them, God. That means they're bowing down to idols. They're stooping down to heathen practices. They're following the ways of the peoples of the east with all of their silver and gold. Just like Hosea said, God gave them all this silver and gold and they didn't know God gave it to them. They attributed it to themselves. You know, I read that verse, I remember a man that was a postman, walked into the horse stables over here, the Hall of Administration, the old one, the library annex one time, and he handed me one of these United States and Britain in prophecies to give it back to us at return address wrong. And he said, yeah, he said, I've read that stuff. Said, that isn't right at all. Said, the only reason we're where we are is because we've got it up here. And I think about that when I read that. Hosea said the people didn't know God gave them all that prosperity and oil and all that wealth. And that's what he's saying here. Now he goes on and says, enter into the rock and hide you in the dust for fear of the eternal and for the glory of his majesty. Does that ring any bells in the New Testament? Well, it ought to. You remember Revelation 6? You ought to turn there and show. Now he's beginning to talk about the time of the sixth seal when people run and hide and try to avoid the trumpet plagues that are just ahead. Notice Revelation 6. Verse 12, he beheld when he'd opened the sixth seal. So right after the time of Israel's tribulation and the captivity that's coming, all of a sudden, there's a great earthquake. The sun becomes black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon becomes as blood, and the stars of heaven fall to the earth, like a fig tree casting overripe figs, shaken of a mighty wind. The heaven departed as a scroll when it's rolled together. Every mountain and island are moved out of their places. So great calamity is about ready to come as soon as Israel goes into captivity. Time is very brief after that. It's all going to happen in a mighty big hurry. The heavens depart like a scroll. Mountains and islands moved out of their places. All of a sudden, the kings of the earth and the great and the rich and the chief captains and the mighty men and every bondman and free man try to hide themselves from these trumpet plagues that are coming. Hide themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains. And say to the mountains and rocks, fall on us, hide us from the face of him that sits on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb. So when people are going to try to run into the rocks and hide, it's right before God supernaturally intervenes and starts bringing things to a quick climax with four trumpet plagues, and then battling these nations at Armageddon in the seventh trumpet, and then pouring out the last plagues on the people trying to destroy the earth. You might notice as you're reading Revelation 6, and he talks about many running and hiding from the wrath of the Lamb, because the great day of his wrath. So, you know, the day of the Lord is the time of those plagues, those trumpet plagues, as well as the seven last plagues. That's the wrath of the Lamb. That's the great day of his wrath. And notice the question, who shall be able to stand? That's the question answered in the next chapter. Who doesn't have to run and hide and try to avoid the wrath of the Lamb with the trumpet plagues and the Armageddon? Who will be able to stand? Well, after those things he saw some people sealed. So they didn't have to run and hide. They were able to stand. Now you're going to find out he asked that question in prophecy too. Who will be able to stand? So you wait and see as we go on through that. Okay, going on back here again then. Enter into the rock and hide you in the dust for fear of the Eternal and for the glory of His majesty. So you know, when you roll the heavens back like a scroll, what keeps God's glory from shining down from up above? Not a thing. And that's why it says in chapter 7 of Revelation, they stood before the throne. They didn't go to heaven. When you roll the heavens apart like a window shade flipping up, what keeps the light from shining in? Not a thing. So all of a sudden, they are frightened by the glory of His majesty. And at a time like that, the lofty looks of man are going to be humbled. Some beast and false prophet promising a millennium. Some Asiatic king with an army of 200 million promising final oriental control of the world. The lofty looks of man are going to be humbled. The haughtiness of man is going to be bowed down. And the Eternal alone is going to be exalted in that day. See that term? In that day. Well, that's the day when the Eternal alone is going to be exalted. That's the day when the lofty looks of man are going to be humbled and the haughtiness of man is going to be bowed down. It's right after the heavenly signs that terrify people and God punishes these Asiatic hordes and European beast power with trumpet plagues as they're battling for world supremacy. Alright. He said in the last days, verse 1, now he says, in that day, and now notice verse 12, for the day of the Lord. They're all one and the same. In the last days, in that day, the day of the Lord. They're all one and the same. For the day of the Lord of hosts shall be upon everyone that's proud and lofty, and upon everyone that's lifted up. So all these demon-inspired leaders that have been promising their followers world supremacy, boy, all of a sudden, that's going to be brought down. Everyone that's lifted up will be brought low. Even some that have been lifted up like the cedars of Lebanon, high and lifted up, like the oaks of Bashan, on all the great world empires, the high mountains, upon all the smaller countries that had atomic power that got lifted up by it, they're going to be brought low. Upon every high tower and every fenced wall, fortresses of protection, upon all the ships of Tarshish, upon all pleasant pictures or idols, pagan idols. The loftiness of man is going to be bowed down and the haughtiness of men is going to be made low and the Eternal alone shall be exalted in that day. That's a repeat of verse 11. You're going to find that repeated many times in Isaiah. It's a definite time of the seventh trumpet when Christ comes back and takes over at the time these other powers are about ready to wipe man off the earth, and then the Eternal alone's exalted. And that's when all the idols are going to be utterly abolished. No more Hinduism, Buddhism, no more Baalism, no more of the Islam religion. They shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth for fear of the Eternal and for the glory of His majesty. When He arises to shake terribly. That's what we read in Revelation, the earthquake, great earthquake. Sure enough, when God decides the time is for intervention and Christ arises to shake terribly the earth, and the heaven rolls back like a scroll and the trumpet plagues start getting poured out, and Christ catches those world powers about ready to annihilate each other in the Middle East, then that's going to be the end, and He's going to pour out the plagues. That's all going to happen very briefly. In that day, notice that term again and again and again, three times already in the one chapter. In that day, a man's going to cast his idols of silver and gold, which they've made each one for himself to worship, to the moles and to the bats. So everybody's got their own patron saint, you know, their own god, their own little particular temple they worship in. They're going to cast those idols to the bats and moles. They've been lied to. These world leaders have been misleading them. Their gods aren't going to do anything for them. And once God's glory begins to shine through and his plagues start falling. They're going to go into the clefts of the rocks and into the tops of the ragged rocks for fear of the Eternal and because of the glory of his majesty when he arises to shake terribly the earth. Seize you from man whose breath is in his nostrils, for wherein is he to be accounted of?